My name is Caoimhe, and I'm involved in Dublin Book Festival and in History Ireland. So on behalf of both, you're very welcome. Big thank you to Dublin Port for hosting us today. I hope you all find it okay. And just a quick note of housekeeping, if there's an unlikely fire, you go back out the way you came and just gather at the flagpoles up to the right. So without further ado, I'll pass over to Tommy and he'll introduce your speakers. And I encourage you to have a look at the programme. There's more on this afternoon and tomorrow in Smock Alley. So pick up a programme or check out dublinbookfestival.com. Thank you.
Thank you, Caoimhe. Good afternoon, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Head School, part of the Dublin Festival of Books. And we're delighted to be here. So I'm your head schoolmaster, Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland magazine, and I'll assume you're all subscribers. So lots of familiar faces here. Of course, just because you're familiar faces doesn't mean you're a subscriber, but, you know, I'll let that rest with your conscience. Anyway, today we're going to look at the Great Hunger and the popularity of the travelling exhibition. It's Quinnipiac. That university with the funny name, right. The Coming Home exhibition, which will be opening up in the Gasworks in Derry in January. So the popularity of that and the release of the film Black 47. How many people have seen the film Black 47? Okay, so we may have a chat about that. And many people have seen the exhibition, by the way, the Coming Home. So most people have seen it, yeah, and myself included. Okay. Now, for a reassessment of Europe's greatest demographic crisis of the 19th century, we have gathered here a stellar panel, John Gibney, who's the editor of The Great Irish Famine. This is a collaboration between Pen and Sword and History Ireland magazine. John will explain what that's all about shortly. On the far right, left here, we have Patricia Byrne, author of The Preacher and the Prelate, The Achill Mission Colony and The Battle for Souls in Famine Ireland. That's published by Irish Academic Press. And then finally here on my left, we have Peter Gray. Now, Peter has a chapter, The Great Irish Famine, 1845 to 1850, in Jimmy Kelly's volume 3 of the Cambridge History of Ireland. Now, I have all the books here except that one because it's so big, such a huge, heavy tome, we couldn't actually lift it here in front of you. But it is being currently reviewed in History Ireland, so we've done two of the volumes. And we'll be doing the other two in the next couple of issues. Maybe Peter Gray, if I could start with you. Here's a simple question for you. What are you telling us in this chapter about the famine? I mean, maybe this might be an opportunity just to give us a brief recap on the basic facts and figures about the potato famine, which can sometimes get lost in other arguments.
Yeah. Well, it's a great privilege to be asked to write the chapter on the famine in the Cambridge History of Ireland, which is kind of a landmark publication, is kind of pulling together or attempting to pull together a kind of generation's worth of research on Irish history. So, but then there's the huge challenges involved as well, because you've got 8,000 or 9,000 words to pull together, a narrative and also your interpretation and understanding of this very complex and very problematic episode in Irish history. So what I tried to do in that chapter is to give a kind of a narrative, essentially setting out what happened, the disease in the potato crop, the reason why that had such a huge impact in Irish society, the failure of the state to respond adequately, the landlord behaviour, the leading to the mass clearances, the role of public charity or public charity and why that was inadequate as a response, and then the kind of the demographic consequences of all of this, with about 1 million deaths due to starvation and famine related diseases, and 1 million forced into emigration in the period between 1845 and 1851. So, I mean, the chapter really is to have to kind of pull all this together and then to give kind of my interpretation, which I've kind of been working on as I've been kind of researching the Great Famine for about 25 years now, which is my argument essentially is that the state has a high degree of responsibility for what happens, even within all the constraints and limitations which limit what the state can do. It nevertheless still has a high degree of responsibility for the scale of mortality. And the reasons for that lie in the field of ideology and the kind of ideological construction of what's happening during the Great Famine as well.
And how, Peter, how How has thinking on the famine developed then? I mean, how would you sum it up? Like, I mean, I know there's different aspects to it, but what's different about what's been written now to what might have been written 30 or 40 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, if you go back to say to the earlier mid-1980s, there's remarkably little historical writing about the Great Famine. We've kind of Cecil Woodham Smith's Great Book of 1962. We've got the Edwards and Williams collection from 1956, and then older nationalist and Catholic histories. But really, you know, very little academic writing about the famine. And then we have, really from the mid-80s, a kind of transformation of that space.
Right.
As you've got serious economic histories of the famine by people like Joel McKeer and Cormac O'Groda. And then in the 90s, you've got kind of interpretations and research into how the state responds by people like Christine Keneally and myself. You've got studies of how the churches respond by Donald Kerr and other people looking at the role of
so there's all explosion.
So we're now kind of significantly further on, and a lot of this is pulled together. And I can't praise this book highly enough. And just in recent years, the Atlas that was published in 2012, edited by Willie Smith and his team down in Cork, has done, I think, a huge amount to pull together the recent scholarship on the...
Can I just throw on something before I forget it? Was the 150th anniversary of the Great Hunger, was that significant in this whole development of scholarship?
I think a lot of the scholarship was beginning before that. And certainly, I myself was starting to work on this subject really at the end of the 1980s, well before the sesquicentenary in the mid-90s. But it certainly raised the public interest and the public profile of the Great Famine. The opening of the Famine Museum at Strokestown, I think, was a major step forward. The high profile that Mary Robinson, as president, gave to famine history in her kind of public presentations, I think, was
important.
Yeah, but
it seems to me there was quite a positive interaction between the Academy and the wider sphere of public history.
Yeah.
Okay. John Gibney, can I go on to you now? Because... if I might say so modestly, you know, History Ireland was part of this explosion of scholarship because there was no shortage of copy on famine-related matters in the 1990s when History Ireland started. And, of course, Peter, you were involved on the editorial board at that stage. So, John, can you just give us an idea? What's this pen and sword collaboration with History Ireland? What's this book all about?
I suppose it's basically about getting your back catalogue, Tommy, and selling it to the Brits. in a glib
so
way.
Serving it back to them. Yes.
I mean, History Ireland has been going for about 25 years, and a lot of 27 contributors.
27, actually.
27.
26.
It's going for 26. A while, anyway. But, you know, there's obviously that leads to an extensive back catalogue, and the back catalogue would contain articles by a lot of leading scholars, you know, on the various fields which have written. I mean, Peter has a couple of articles in the anthology that's under discussion here. And the idea was that, I suppose as you go further back in time, these things get a little bit more buried. And Pen and Sword, who will be a UK publisher with a focus on history and military history in particular, basically History Ireland and Pen and Sword entered into a collaboration. And the idea was, why not come up with a series of volumes that can utilise the articles in the back catalogue? And the History Ireland article is shortish, you know, but there will be enough of them on certain subjects to form coherent overviews of those subjects. And the famine is the first. The second one is going to be about the 1798 rebellion and issues around that. So, I mean, Tommy, you didn't have the time. So someone who'd worked for History Ireland more intensively in the past than necessarily I do now, I got roped into kind of use my familiarity with the back catalogue to try and pull them together. So the idea is to use that material. And it's not every article that was ever published in the magazine. I mean, because you want to create a coherent book at the end of the day rather than, say, just a ragbag collection. Hopefully we've done that. There will be articles on, say, like broad brushstroke overviews of the context of the famine, an examination of the lumper potato by Cormac O'Groda, one of the leading experts on the famine. And you can't really have a discussion of potato famine without a discussion of the potato that was so afflicted during the 1840s. Articles on various aspects of, say, the ideology relating to the famine, institutions, political institutions, the police, disease, a sequence of articles on relief efforts, you know, both public and private, given that Patricia's here, worth noting, one of them is about Quaker relief efforts in the west of Ireland, which has an obvious resonance to your own book, and concluding with pieces on, say, the long-term social and demographic impact of the famine, and the way in which historians have looked at the famine over time. So it's meant to, a lot of this would have been generated in and around the 150th anniversary, and you know, as we inquired of authors if they wished to update their pieces. Some did, some felt they still got the job done and stood the test of time. But the idea is to kind of, I suppose, take a lot of that work that was published in the 1990s and the early noughties, and I suppose turn it into a coherent volume and a short overview of the famine, and one that in particular you'd hope that would be of interest to audiences overseas who would know something about the famine but would know a great deal about it, but one that we would hope is of interest to an Irish audience as well.
One of the articles, for example, is Rob Goodbody's on the Quakers. Now, the Quakers get a positive there's a positive view of them because their assistance had no strings attached. Now, Patricia, that's put it mildly, that's in contrast to the approach taken by the subject of your book, which is a bit broader. And I want to give you an opportunity because you got roped into this discussion because famine is in your title. Tell us a little bit about
famine is in my bones as well.
Tell us a little bit. No, it does bear on the famine, but just talk to us a little bit about the Achill Mission.
My story, it's a narrative non-history of the Achill Mission colony. And it's, I suppose, differs from the others in that it's very much a zoomed in, close up, microscopic look at one particular area, Achill Island, one particular larger than life individual, Edward Nangle, and one enterprise, the Achill Colony. And it's framed, if any of you have read my book, you see it's framed in the context of a kind of personal journey for me, realizing that the trauma of what happened is very much still alive in Achill, and me working through that and walking through the island and listening to the folklore. What I'm really interested in is the story is in three phases. And the phases, I think, take in really the big themes of the famine, because Edward Nangle came to Achill having gotten, he was an extreme evangelical Protestant. He was very much imbued by what was going on in the Second Reformation in Cavan and around Lord Farnham's estate.
Where's he from, Patricia?
He was originally from County Meath, but ended up as a curate in Arva in County Cavan. And all of the Second Reformation stuff of the 1920s really imbued him with this ideology that really came to fruition.
What denomination was he, Patricia?
Sorry?
What denomination was he?
Protestant, evangelical Protestant.
But was he Church of Ireland or?
Well, Protestantism, he was Church of Ireland, but there were various...
Right, yeah, but he was at the evangelical wing.
And he was
wing.
At the
yeah.
evangelical. So he was imbued with this, particularly on Lord Farnham's estate, where Lord Farnham was using conversions and so on to make better tenants. He came to Achill. He decided to set up a colony in Achill, which would have a mix of temporal stuff, like farm reclamation, land reclamation, orphanages, hospital and so on. And at the heart of it were scriptural schools. So in that first phase, and obviously he locked horns with John McHale, but in that first phase, he was actually in Achill for a decade before the famine broke out, Superism, in the sense of people changing faith in returns for material benefit, was happening in the decade leading up to the famine. And it was actually interesting that before the famine happened, people were doing formal public changes of faith in Achill, which stopped at the beginning of the famine. So that whole groundwork, if you like, of people converting and coming from all over Mayo and all over Ireland to take up residence at the colony and to convert for what they were getting. The famine came then, and of course what happened in Achill in the famine is that Edward Nangle and the Achill Mission started to feed the children in the famine schools. One would say almost a very natural thing to do. He was protecting his schools against John McHale's schools. There was a fierce battle going over on the schools. I don't think Edward Nangle would have realised the famine would have gone on, except he actually saw it then as an instrument almost of God by feeding the children in the schools. It obviously accelerated greatly the attraction of the children going to the schools.
It's never let a good crisis go to waste.
Yeah, but just one final point. What really interests me, Edward Nangle and the Achill Mission Connolly then purchased the estate from the encumbered estates. So you had the whole progression from the scriptural schools through the famine and superism to then the Achill Mission becoming the landlord. And what I found in Achill is almost the land became almost a more sore point. But it was actually all of them together, I think, which created that sort of trauma. So it was a hugely dramatic enterprise right through the 19th century in Achill.
Okay, tell you what, can you just come back to the question of historiography, and maybe Peter and John in this one. Because, John, one of the articles, that the last article in the collection is Jim Donnelly's one, The Great Famine, Its Interpreters, Old and New. Now, this would have been published in the early 90s, right? Mm. I remember I was quite excited about publishing that at the time, I have to say, because he took a right go at the previous generation of historians, in particular that collection that was published in the 1950s. Mm. Peter, if you want to just talk about that, maybe just explain what that collection in the 50s was, first of all.
Yeah, okay, so this was published in 1956 as The Great Famine, Studies in Irish History, edited by Dudley Edwards and T.D. Williams. It was actually funded, bizarrely, by De Valera.
It was meant to come out in 1945.
I think the money came in 1945
or 1946. Historians worked at a more leisurely pace.
It took them 10 years to actually produce it. Of course, when it finally came out, it was not what De Valera, in a sense, had paid for. It was, you know, the classic, what is now described as revisionist history of the Great Famine. The introduction, which is actually written by Kevin Nolan, who's not credited with it, but it was written by Kevin Nolan from UCD, tends to downplay the traditional nationalist interpretation, to play up a kind of an understanding we should have of the problems that faced British governors and administrators in the time. It suggested that no other government would have acted in any different way. You know, in some ways, it kind of makes excuses. It's kind of an apologia for government during the Great Famine. And that's what I think attracted then the critique of the next generation of historians, Jim Donnelly, in that article, Cormac O'Groda, an article he wrote as well. And he wrote a whole article about how that book was put together, which is very critical of its content. And, you know, that had an impact on me starting off my research at that time,
right,
as
right.
well, and thinking, you know, what are the arguments here? What are the issues?
Do you want to say any more about that, the Donnelly piece,
well,
John?
I suppose there are two things about it. On the one hand, we do hear the term revisionism is one of these terms bandied around in Irish historical writing a lot. Maybe more in a way that's more relevant to the 1980s and 1990s than today. But, and I should say, Jim Donnelly is an American historian, you know, which is based at the University of Wisconsin. And what he wrote was, I mean, one criticism of, you know, to use that term revisionism loosely, one criticism of what revisionist historical writing from within the academy was sometimes that it was throwing the baby out of the bathwater. That in trying to explore Irish history in a more complex manner, at times it could be replacing one orthodoxy with another and could become misleading in its own right. If, for example, you know, the famine was just a result of kind of structural problems or issues in Irish society, then you might reach a point at which, well, it just happened without any agency. And this was something Donnelly was quite critical of, and he was trying to kind of, I suppose, counterbalance it. Now, he did reference the book that Peter has mentioned, you know, which Lillipup Presbury published a few years ago. But Donnelly took particular interest in, I suppose, one of the most well-known writers of the famine, about the famine, who was the 19th century polemicist John Mitchell, who formulated that famous line about, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but God created the blight, but the English created the famine. And Donnelly, I don't think any professional historian would accept that thesis today, but Donnelly was making the point, look, there's a reason why John Mitchell was saying these things. Even if you factor in the fact that, right, he was writing a propagandist tract at the time, there's a reason why he did touch upon some things that have a substantial grain of truth in them. Like, one point he makes in the article is that, you know, John Mitchell's critique of Charles Trevelyan. He basically says, well, a lot of modern academics would probably say the similar things about Trevelyan. They mightn't use the same language. And the point he was making was that you kind of do have to go back to the perspective of how things looked at the time. And why did someone like that write that in the context of the 19th century, rather than just dismiss it as a polemic? Because it is a polemic. But Donnelly did make the point, there's a few things in here that, you know, there's a lot that Mitchell got wrong, but there's a few things that he got right. And that, to a certain extent, perhaps the lesson you might take from that is that it's better, perhaps you're better off engaging with the reality of how people lived and existed at the time, and you're not going to get all of that. Because one article that I would love to included in the anthology, except for the fact that it doesn't exist, is an article reflecting the voices of those who experienced and suffered within the famine themselves. Now, other historians have written on that. You know, Cormac O'Groda has written on it. Neil O'Casson has written on it, often using folkloric material. But these are, you don't necessarily get the voices of famine victims. Or you don't always get the voices of those who experienced it. And the point that Donnelly was making, that was perhaps look away from the debates amongst historians, important as they are, and just bear in mind that people writing in the 19th century did so for a reason. And while some of those reasons can be critiqued and left to one side, sometimes they're coming from somewhere, and that perspective shouldn't be entirely invalidated. And he was saying that as someone who did dismiss a lot of what Mitchell was saying, but did also point out this guy is pointing out a few things in which there are a few grains of truth.
Okay, well, alongside that revisionist trend was the sort of conspiracy theory that the famine was genocide and that academic historians were not recognising that fact. Now, it seems to me that, judging by what I see on the net, right, that discussion continues to rage. So, Peter, how is there any chance of a reconciliation or coming together on this, right? Or are these people... I mean, the problem with people who have conspiracy theories is it's a closed, sealed argument, right? Is there any point in engaging with this whole thing?
Well, I think you have to acknowledge that there's a huge emotional power in the arguments for genocide, which goes back to John Mitchell. It also goes back to the experience of many of those who survived and to whom Mitchell's words appeal in the mid-19th century, late 19th century, as ways of interpreting what they'd been through and how to rebuild their lives afterwards and how to give meaning to that. I think there are problems with it. There has been a recent attempt to restate the Mitchellite position. Tim Pat Coogan's book, The Famine Plot, in 2013, attempts, I think, unsuccessfully and not particularly powerfully to restate the Mitchellite position. If we were talking about this earlier, if you go back to what genocide is defined by the United Nations in 1948, if you want to read out the definition.
Well, first of all, the thing about genocide is it's the term isn't coined until 1945, and that's problematic straight away.
Yeah.
But let's leave that to one side. I mean, that raises a philosophical question, just because a term hasn't been applied. Has the phenomenon existed anyway?
Yeah,
let's park that for the moment.
Mitchell uses the term extermination.
So it's pretty close. Yeah. So it was drawn up in 1948, and it says any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial or religious group as such. A, killing members of the group. B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. D, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. E, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. Now, does this fall within that category? What do you think?
I'm sort of interested the way this becomes, is it genocide or is it not? You know, a really binary kind of thing. What I found in the course of my research on the whole evangelical Protestant thing, which developed in the 1820s, it was a force for good in Lord Farnham's estate. Take these popish peasants, convert them, make them more temperate, give them civilized living. So it was a force of good. Edward Nangle took that and he tried to bring it to Ackle. It also led in to a certain type of political philosophy. In fact, sometimes I think of the economic collapse a few years ago and who was to blame for that. It was a political philosophy that inculcated everybody, including Edward Nangle in Ackle. And I suppose we try, a bit like in Black 47, we tried to say, was it genocide, was it not genocide? And I think the way Peter describes it in the book, it's difficult to say. It was very definitely, and certainly there were some people who felt we need to get rid of people, the population is too large, we need to bring the farms down and so on. But it certainly infiltrated the whole system, including, I was quite taken aback by the way it infiltrated the whole Ackle Mission colony, right through to the period when Edward Nangle and the Ackle Mission became a landlord, and which it continued through that. But to actually say in a very definite way it was a deliberate genocide, it's quite a big jump.
I mean,
it seems to me. I mean, the crucial word in the 1948 definition is intent.
Yeah.
So to use that definition effectively, you need to demonstrate there's intent on the part of the state to destroy the Irish people or the Irish Catholic people or a portion of it, and then you've got to essentially find a kind of motivation for that. And I've been working on this, as I say, for about 25 years, working through the private papers of government ministers and administrators.
No,
I can't find that intent. What I can find is I mean, what fits much more easily with what we now describe as a neoliberal ideological preoccupation with forcing people to help themselves, with making them, you know, making them work, you know, self-sufficiency.
These sound very familiar notions of social welfare.
I mean, this is the ideology that motivates people like Charles Trevelyan. I mean, classical liberalism and what I describe as moralism, essentially saying the problem in Ireland is a moral problem. It affects both landlords and peasants. They need to be forced to help themselves. And if the state gives too much, they're never going to do that. And to me, fundamentally, that is the reason why the state doesn't mobilise all the resources potentially it could have, and which it demonstrated had the capacity to do in one moment in the summer of 1847, when the state is feeding over 3 million people from public soup kitchens, demonstrates what can be done if it mobilises its resources, but then backs away from that and essentially leaves Ireland to its own devices.
Can I just remind the audience that you are invited to jump in at any stage? So if anyone's any views on this question, you know, just put your hand up and we'll bring you into the discussion. On this question of responsibility, then, I mean, okay, it may be impossible to find intent, but certainly there was opportunism here, I suggest. I mean, you know, the idea of not letting a good crisis go to waste. I mean, the fact is that governments use crises to push through certain policies, right? We've seen it ourselves here in the last 10 years. My wage packet hasn't recovered to its pre-crisis. I don't know if anyone else is here, but you know, I'm still waiting to get all that money back. My point being, Peter, there certainly was intent for certain policies which were detrimental.
Yeah. Well, I think this is very much in Patricia's side of the country, in her area. The people, I think, who are acting opportunistically are some of the great landlords who are seeing as an opportunity to repurpose their land from tillage agricultural to pastoral agricultural, to clear the people to create grassland farms, which is where the money is going to be made in the future. There's a lot of evidence for that. Is the state complicit in that? It allows it to happen. Does it have a deliberate policy to bring that about? That's more problematic. I think the state's attitude towards the economy is a laissez-faire one. The economic actors should decide what policy should be rather than the state. The state is kind of backing away from responsibility.
Is there...
On the whole discussion, one of the things that I found in writing my book, we can analyse and talk rationally on who was responsible, but it's to capture the emotive... The whole emotive power of what happened and the film, this is what went on in the film. And what really surprised me in terms of Ackle, and talking to an old man in Ackle who remembers his grandfather talking about the Ackle Mission colony, what really surprised me was the power. I thought the famine and the deaths and the emigration would be the more powerful, but how that the land almost became the more powerful. Right. And when I looked at the oral history, they said, yes, our people died and our people left, and the deserted village, we might talk about that again.
Yeah.
But we had that land up on that mountain, and we were driven down to Douai, and we had to put more land out of sand and bog and whatever. And it was that surprised me, how the land almost came on top of the famine and was the more powerful emotion. And they were still looking at the land and still looking at the places where they felt they should have been in their land. So that was really interesting to me, how those three phases kind of built on one another. You know, the schooling in the 1830s where McHale and Nangle were fighting over the schools, then the famine and then the land. And there were only three decades, like there were a decade one after the other. Mm. And all of these coalesced in very powerful oral, powerful memories that are still there to this very day.
Could you just talk about the deserted village? This is on Slieve Moor, because as a child we went to holidays to Ackle, and then a few years ago I brought some Danish in-laws. And it's amazing when you bring somebody from outside Ireland. And I mean, to me, it is the famine monument. And there's very little there, just the deserted village. How many people have seen it? Just curious. It's a fair number of people, right? And the effect it had on them. I mean, they just went quiet, right? I mean, they didn't speak for half an hour, and I gradually explained the background to it. When was that depopulated? I mean, that was around in Angus time.
First of all, if you have seen it, and I sometimes wonder why is it so dramatic. I think it's dramatic. It's at the slopes of Sleevemore Mountain.
There's nothing there.
It's on the edges of the Atlantic. But the extent of it, there are actually 80 to 100 cottages, roofless cottages, over a mile. And
it's
you can actually see the lazy beds stretching out up into the mountains. So in terms of just the visuals of it, people began to leave during the famine, the Gregory Clause, people...
Who owned that land? Whose land was that?
Well, it was, I suppose, commonage.
This was people literally on the edge.
And then they began to leave through the famine for various reasons. But then it became part, or the areas close to it, became part of the estate that the Acclimission Colony took over. And, of course, it became mixed up with some of that. And the German writer, Heinrich Böll, some of you might have heard of his Irish journal, he was in Achill, and he came upon the deserted village. He called it a skeleton of human habitation. He said, why did nobody tell me about this? So I think of all the images, and it's actually in the Coming Home exhibition very powerfully, the deserted village has an enormous power in terms of a visual of the famine years.
Tell you, I just want to move things on a bit, because one of the things that comes up in the collection, John, is just the detail of the famine. How people died, right? For example, because I remember in particular Larry Geary's article on the epidemic diseases of the famine. So, like, what was the big killer in the 1840s?
Well, I suppose it's fairer to think of famine. A better description of deaths and the famine would be mortality rather than outright starvation. There's no shortage of outright starvation, but malnutrition weakened immune systems, rendered people more vulnerable to disease. The climatic conditions of the 1840s, extremely wet conditions for a couple of years. Diseases of cholera, typhus, dysentery were pretty virulent killers as well. And these were diseases that existed. Cholera outbreaks were, I used to work in the last Enfield Cemetery, my office looked out in a cholera pit, which was a charming thought when you're coming into work. But outbreaks of disease were by no means uncommon in Ireland. But an outbreak of disease in a country in which large chunks of the population, the poorest of the poor, were severely malnourished and rendered vulnerable, made disease, probably as equally significant a killer as outright starvation. Certainly in Dublin, Cormac O'Godden did some research into this, and it looks like more people died in Dublin of disease than starvation.
That wouldn't be in the popular imagination. People assume that it's all west of Ireland.
Oh no! Well, the thing is, though, the two figures to bear in mind with the depopulation, the famine, is 1 million died, 1 million emigrated. How do you emigrate in the middle of the 19th century if not by boat, and you can't get onto a boat unless you get to a port? So ironically, Dublin's population actually went up during the famine and bucked the trend, and the same is true, as we call it, Belfast and Cork, all of which are major ports. Now, if you look at the layout of Dublin, where, I suppose, traditionally the west of the city would be its artisan areas, places such as the Liberties, the first port of call to people coming up, people who are able to escape from the famine. Because a lot of people who died had no means of getting out, but those who could get to Dublin were arriving in places that were old, that were overcrowded, that were already notorious for, the tenements we associate with the 20th century. Those slum conditions existed in Dublin in the 1840s, and in fact, officially, in the early 20th century, when Dublin slums were being investigated, the 1840s was isolated by official inquiries as the date when the problem really began to steamroller, when you had an influx of people arriving into the city, overcrowding and disease and places that had very, very poor sanitation caused massive mortality in the city. And certainly O'Grada's research, which was into the death tolls of the North and South Dublin unions, indicated that more people died of disease in Dublin during the famine. Now I think it's fair to say that in the overall conditions you could view these people as victims of the famine, just not victims of starvation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tommy John just reminds me of Mrs. Nicholson, Asenath Nicholson. I'm sure you've heard of her. She features in my book. And you mentioned the Atlas of the Irish Famine, and there's a wonderful chapter in it. And she was an extraordinary woman, an American widow who actually travelled all over Ireland and really gave us wonderful accounts of what was going on in the slums in Dublin, right across to Achill. And she had her own disagreements with Edward and Angle, stayed with the people, And even though she came from the same background, she was, you know, she had her Bibles under her cloak to bring the Bibles as she went around Ireland, yet she had quite a different approach to Edward Nangle in that she, like Tuke, the Quaker, she did not at all agree with linking conversion to the proselytising. But she gives us an extraordinary first-hand account of what went on in the slums and right through Ireland.
Peter, could you come in a little bit on tell us how the workhouse was supposed to work? I mean, the theory and the practice, if you like. Because this bears on the landlord response, because they were paying for this whole system. Maybe just if you could explain how it worked.
Well, the workhouse,
or not, as the case may be.
The workhouse system is set up in 1838 before the famine. It's never intended to deal with a crisis like the Great Famine. But the decision is made in the spring of 1847 by the government that it is going to be the sole means of relief. Once the summer is over and the new harvest is collected in 1847, the poor law system and the 130 workhouses are going to be the sole means of relieving any residual destitution, as they call it. Now, as we know, the famine doesn't end in the summer of 1847. There's very few potatoes planted, so there's no potato crop. The grain harvest is not great either, and there's massive unemployment. And then we've got clearances coming in as well. So from the autumn of 1847, the poor law system and the workhouses and the workhouse yards, because outdoor relief is permitted from the autumn of 1847, become the epicentre of this catastrophe. The workhouses are vastly overcrowded, so they hire more buildings, old factories and warehouses. Those become massively overcrowded. The hospital wings are overwhelmed with people with typhus fever and relapsing fever, with dysentery, with ordinary diseases, which are, as John said, massively enhanced by famine malnutrition, like measles and scurvy. And the money simply isn't
there. That's
what I'm
saying. Where's the revenue?
System.
Where's the revenue coming from?
The revenue is rates on the land, which is local taxation. Yeah. It's meant to be paid half by the tenant farmer and half by the landlord. Though for the smallest tenant farmers, it's paid entirely by the landlord. So the revenue simply isn't coming in. The government uses charitable money. It uses the remains of the British Relief Association collections to subsidise the rates in the West for a year. That money runs out in the summer of 1848. And we have another year of famine in which there's virtually no funding coming from outside the West. You know, so we've got bankruptcy and collapse into catastrophic destitution.
So essentially you have a system. At the very time it needs more revenue, its revenue stream is collapsing.
Yep. Yep.
So this doesn't make sense right now. From the point of view of the landlords, right, their expenses are going up, their income has collapsed. So is it no wonder they were clearing people off the land?
And like people like the Marquess of Sligo, who would have been a good landlord, would have done a lot of good. I mean, he was even forced to clear some of his tenants.
Well, the point is, if you didn't clear, you were going to go bankrupt. Far be for me to argue the case for landlords here, but I'm just trying to tease out the motivation here, because
if we look at landlords respond in different ways. Not all landlords do the same thing. So Patricia mentioned that the Marquess of Sligo, he and his family start off with being relatively generous, cutting their costs, but then makes the argument, I must clear or be cleared myself, my family will lose everything. Massive clearances. But one of the neighbouring landlords, George Henry Moore, who's a Catholic landowner, later leader of the Independent Irish Party, doesn't clear anybody from his estates. Daniel O'Connell basically bankrupts himself before he dies by spending, and then they have to sell off his house, etc., and his library. Especially spends his own money subsidising his tenants down in West Kerry. So different landlords respond in different ways. On the other hand, you've got people like Lord Lucan at Ballinarobe, who just clears 2,000 tenants off the land.
And in Achill, Sir Richard O'Donnell was forced to sell his, and the Achill Mission Connolly acquired the bulk of the estate, but they in turn either sold on to people like William Pike, who became quite a notorious landlord, and they in turn sublet to people like Captain Boycott. So suddenly in Achill in the 1850s, where you had Sir Richard O'Donnell as the dominant landlord, now you had a whole lot of different owners, different people coming in, like Boycott and his history and so on. The fisheries were sold off to a man called Hector. So in over a decade, the whole face of Achill was transformed, and not just transformed by the ownership of land, but transformed by the church, because Mikhail started his aggressive fight back, and the Bunnacurry Monastery came, churches began to be built. So an extraordinary transformation in that decade in terms of land ownership and construction and so on.
How successful is Nagel from his own point of view in actually, you know, converting people? What was the percentage Catholic Protestant breakdown?
Well, a lot of my research was based on the Achill Missionary Herald. If you want to go through, it's about 30 years of it. There's lots of it in the National Library. But one of the stats he uses himself is in 1849, 4 years into the famine, the Archbishop, the Protestant Archbishop of Tuam, came to the Achill Mission Colony, and he confirmed 400 children. 90% of whom were converts. So that was something he loved too. So there were certainly hundreds. It began to decline pretty soon because John Mikhail started attracting them back again. Some of them emigrated. So it actually fell back very quickly, but it was certainly several hundred.
Now, John, just going back to the historian collection, there was an election, general election, I think, in 1847. And this is an article by Brian Walker, and my memory of it, what Brian says is that the election really was fought as if the famine wasn't happening at all. It was totally divorced from what was happening on the ground.
Life went on for many people. There's another article that was only published in History Ireland, I think only a couple of issues ago, about conspicuous consumption during the famine. You know, the activities of the elite, regattas, thousands of people going to horse races. You could say that it wasn't an absolute famine, in that the people who it impacted were the poorest of the poor, but there were certainly large swathes of Irish life that were happily, as they saw, trundling on and conducting their business.
I particularly like the sign in a Dublin restaurant on beefsteak and oysters as usual.
And now this one,
very sensitive.
And now this was being criticised at the time, like race meetings, for example, in Tipperary. You'd local newspapers saying, "Well, it's quite possible in hunting season, you know, the hunter's going to be kind of racing past basically people who are starving to death." But it was happening, and life was carrying on fairly in a manner for many people that seems to have been unaffected by the famine. And that's something we need to bear in mind. I mean, the further up the Ireland social ladder you went, the more safely insulated you were from the humanitarian crisis at the bottom of it. And the same would be true of political life. I mean, the Brian Walker article in the collection, it was an election, and it wasn't about the famine. Political life went on, and the social realities of Ireland in the 1840s, the two did not necessarily meet.
And just hold on 1 second, Peter, because I think you've a dissenting view from this.
I think you've got to kind of understand what's happening politically during the famine. So very few people actually have the vote. There's a major extension of who has the vote in 1850, right at the end of the famine, but very few people have the vote. But people had been very interested in elections in the 1830s, 1840s, largely because they'd been mobilised by the O'Connellite movement. You know, these mass meetings that Daniel O'Connell has for repeal of the Union and demanding all sorts of reforms. That movement collapses during the famine because ordinary people are prioritizing survival over political activity. O'Connell himself is dying and then dies in 47. His son is a very weak political leader. You know, so the dynamics that had kind of given life to Irish politics, even for people who didn't have the vote, they'd still turn up at hustings and shout and cheer and cause riots, you know, so they had a leverage over, in some cases, who got elected. That collapses in part during the famine itself. But at the same time, I think if you move into the later years, particularly 48, 49, 50, there's the start of a tenant right movement. You know, those who have survived, farmers who have survived, are banding together and forming political organisations to defend themselves against clearance and increased rents. So we get a kind of major shift by 1852 when there's a kind of, you know, a tenant league election. Gavin Duffy, who had been kind of, you know, involved in Young Ireland, is at the centre of that. William Sharman Crawford, who I'm writing about at the moment, in the north as well. You know, so I think, you know, to some extent it's true that there is a kind of lull in Irish formal political activity in 1847 because people are just trying to survive. Mm-hmm. But it's only a brief thing, and then
okay.
we've got this recovery.
Okay, so it's a bit slightly illusory, you
yeah.
think? Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah, just if you could use the radio mic.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, it's interesting, they say people because, you know, people are from different backgrounds and different circumstances. And, like, there's no doubt about, you know, overall who was responsible in terms of the government at the time and how the landlords responded to the situation and instead used the situation. But I'm particularly interested in how the Irish at various levels responded to the situation. Because as you mentioned, like, as I understand it, you know, rail was being built, bridges were being built, churches were being built. For many, this was through the 40s as well as then into the 50s. This was a sort of a fairly economically vibrant times. And yet, there was this famine situation going on alongside that. And not only how people sort of responded at the time, but then how, in terms of, because there's a sense of that this was a time that we say shopkeepers in particular, that they hoarded some of the produce, so the prices went up at times when people were starving, and also in terms of taking over from where people were evicted at different stages, so that people used the opportunity, and Irish people at different levels of the society, which is something that I think is only beginning to be brought out at this stage by historians, and be interested in comments on that.
There's winners and losers, Peter.
Yeah. I think you're right. I mean, the famine sees both the absolute worst and in some cases the best of human nature and human responses. So if we look at people who are not actually starving, what are they doing? Yes, some people are profiteering. Absolutely no question that's going on. People in the merchant classes, some of the bigger farmers, they're profiteering. Yes, the institutional Catholic Church is still building cathedrals during the Great Famine, so, you know, Killarney Cathedral goes up in the later 1840s. On the other hand, you've got priests and clergy of all denominations who are putting themselves into the front line and dying of famine fever, relief volunteers doing the same thing. There's a very high mortality of people who are, you know, who are themselves not at risk of starvation, but who put themselves into the front line of relief work. You know, so I think, you know, the picture is mixed. We have these kind of very cynical, opportunistic, and exploitative behaviours, very common. But we also have people who are engaged in self-sacrificing behaviours as well.
Patricia, can I bring you in here? Because there is a kind of a glib kind of a folk memory that the Catholic Church and the clergy didn't step up to the plate. You know, this is something that's given as an argument almost for superism, that at least they were giving the people a soup, that the Catholic clergy kind of stayed at home.
Yeah, and in fact, in the course of my research, I would have found that Edward and Angle would have criticised them, and I didn't see a huge stepping up from the Catholic clergy during the famine years in Achill. But yet, towards the end of the famine, when they saw the MacHale in particular, saw all the children being fed and moving over to Catholic, then there was a very aggressive, and it was driven by Cullen as well, a very aggressive reaction, for instance, by setting up on a Corrie Monastery, almost modelled on the Achill colony itself. Mm-hmm. There was a priest in Achill who wrote, you know, Archbishop Murray in Dublin had a fund, and one of the priests in Achill, who was probably more involved, wrote looking for money. And I was really interested, and he said, I understand the children are going to Edward Nangle schools, but that's totally understandable. Who would not go to schools? I don't judge them. Mm. But certainly Edward Nangle and the Achill colony was much more proactive, it seemed to me, in feeding, in providing employment, and in building up the infrastructure. Like, it was very interesting that over the period of the famine, you were talking about infrastructure happening, there was a huge expansion of the infrastructure of the Achill colony. And at the height of the famine, Edward Nangle raised £6,000 in 1 year. And a lot of that actually went into building up the infrastructure, as well as doing the employment schemes, as well as feeding the children in the schools. So he had a whole apparatus, much stronger than the Catholic apparatus.
But it could be said, let me bring you in on this, Peter, like, from the judging from what you've been saying there about MacHale and Cullen and so on, that humanitarian concern was not front and centre of their concerns. Their concerns was to fight the proselytisers.
The Achill colony was so active during the famine years in Achill that certainly the Catholic Church was a nearly. And Edward, one of the things that John MacHale himself was gathering funds in Tuam, and he was personally sitting up at night doling out the funds, and where they went, or I'm not sure, but he was personally looking after it. But certainly the Achill Mission Connolly was much more proactive in terms of but obviously the criticism is that it was cloaked in this effort at proselytising and getting people to convert to the colony. And that's obviously the pros and cons of the acclimation and the argument that goes on about the acclimation.
Peter, more to say on that?
Yeah, I think it's certainly true that the kind of princes of the church, if you like, are pursuing their pre-existing objectives. But I mean, at the same time, there is a serious Catholic charitable response to the famine. There is a papal letter sent out throughout Europe at the suggestion of Cullen, who's still in Rome in 1847. He's still principal of the Irish College there. So Pius IX sends this letter out to the kind of global Catholic community, and money comes back in through Rome and is channeled to Archbishop Murray in Dublin, who then distributes to parishes in the West. Many of the Catholic clergy in the West do become, because there are no other literate spokespeople for the peasantry, they do become the advocates of the poor. I mean, someone like Archdeacon Sullivan of Kenmare, for example, writing constantly to the government in very, very assertive and graphic language about what's happening to the poor of the district and demanding that the state intervene. You know, so I mean, I think the picture is mixed in terms of how the church responds, but there's a lot of positive in it as well.
Yeah.
Going to be vague. I don't remember the names. Davis, Thomas Davis. Yeah, 1860s. I think he was writing. 1840s. What I read by him was a bit after the famine, because he was criticizing the landlords, many of whom had beautified their estates with the money that was given for relief. And I often wonder about, say, Paris Court Gardens. They were built in the 1840s. So I was just wondering, and other places, if you know anything about that.
Yeah, I mean, Thomas Davis dies in 1845, so he dies before the famine starts. But of course, he's the great, you know, poet and visionary writer of the Young Ireland movement, and the kind of key influence.
Just use the mic if you want to come back. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, it could.
Sorry, I have a book, but I thought it was Thomas Davis. And I thought it was just after the famine that he was writing, criticising.
It could well be someone else from that tradition.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, leveling this criticism that they used the money to beautify their estates and make ports and things like this.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of criticism during the famine that landlords are not using the money not so much to beautify their estates, but to improve their estates, to carry out drainage projects, and build new service roads on their estates, particularly from the public works funding in the first year of the famine. That's one of the reasons you get this backlash in British public opinion. Why should we be paying out money which is then being used by landlords to do what they should be using their own resources to do? So that argument becomes actually one for penny pinching and one for a regressive attitude towards spending. And many of these cases are exaggerated. I mean, what's certainly true is that landlords in the previous half century had spent a lot of money, you know, building new country houses and beautifying their country houses. This comes in the Great Famine. Of course, there's a moral critique against them, you know, for having wasted so much money, you know, drawn from the rents of their own estates and not having improved the lives and conditions of the ordinary people.
But I think the earlier money had come from the Act of Union. You know,
Of them have been paid off for the loss of their political property, you know, their boroughs during the Act of Union. Yeah, that's certainly true.
Gentleman here, yeah.
It's just for the recording. I'd like to hear somebody talk about, maybe from a point of view of neocolonialism. At the time, the British Empire was the greatest empire in the world, and we were its first colony. And I believe Britain always had a policy of exploitation. So when they did say about things, Irish property must pay for Irish poverty, and when you had laissez-faire, providentialism of Trevelyan and so on like that, and like you said about the evangelicals, I believe this was another aspect of the whole neo-colonial approach. And I'm reminded of the Second World War, when against the Jews, you had the Übermenschen and the Untermenschen, and I think the Irish were definitely the Untermenschen. And I believe this informed their policy in dealing with the famine, not allowing imports of corn because of the corn laws would interfere with British agriculture at the time. Eventually, they allowed a couple of ships to come from the United States, given permission to come in. So I think it was a kind of a colonial project, if you like.
Well, I don't like the term neo-colonial because I think the term colonial is sufficient. And I was originally a historian of early modern Ireland, and the concept of Ireland as a colony is something that, shall we say, drifted out of the historiography of Ireland after the Act of Union. You can't understand Irish history in the 16th and 17th century and ignore the fact of widespread colonisation in the south and the north and across the Midlands, the imprint of which survived well into the modern period. And I don't think it's sufficient to say that, well, Ireland was an integral part of the United Kingdom, had representatives of Westminster, but it had a colonial past and had evolved in a certain way. And it's interesting that one thing that historians mightn't be willing to use that framework, historical geographers do. And certainly in the Atlas of the Great Irish Famine, William J. Smith, historical geographer based in UCC, who was one of the editors of it, puts the famine exactly within that framework, the framework of a part of the United Kingdom in which its balance of trade was kind of reorientated into focusing on one particular market, i.e. the remainder of the UK, Britain. And it's interesting that historians might be willing to go down that road because they may feel it's tinged with polemic, but a historical geographer who's going to have a different focus has no problem accepting that. And it's a concept that needs to be let back in a bit more to be analysed and discussed around, not uncritically, but it certainly shouldn't be something that is off the table. It's a valid framework.
I agree with John on that. I mean, some of the most really innovative work on thinking about the long-term and medium-term causation of the famine has been done by Willie Smith and his team in Cork, and also by David Nally in a book called Human Encumbrances, which came out a few years ago. He's a historical geographer, Irish historical geographer based in Cambridge. So I think, I mean, absolutely right. I mean, we do need to remember these long-term structures which are created by the colonial process. Whether that explains in a reductive way the policy adopted in the 1840s, I think is a little bit more problematic. Not least because if we look at the government that's actually in power in the later 1840s, it's a government which had done deals with Irish popular opinion with Daniel O'Connell in the 1830s and again in 1846 when it comes back into power. It's a party which supported Catholic emancipation. It's a party which is pro-free trade, so they don't stop food coming into Ireland. In some ways, it's the opposite. They expect the free market to provide that food coming into Ireland by abolishing the corn laws and by letting the kind of the market solve the problem. So I don't think that government is inherently anti-Irish. I think that they are preoccupied with the idea that market forces will solve the problem of the Great Famine. But in doing that, of course, they're ignoring the structural, you know, subordination of the Irish economy to the English economy, which indeed has been created by the colonial process.
Right. I'd just like to point out that the chair of Irish in Trinity was created just before the famine or around famine times, and it was done with an evangelical purpose. It was Trinity had a chair of Arabic before they had a chair of Irish. Now, they may have had Irish scholars doing history and manuscripts and so on, but they didn't actually have a chair of Irish until the Earl of Roden, who was from County Down, a big Orange man and interested in proselytizing. He thought there should be a chair of Irish because the ministers should be trained in speaking Irish so that they convert the people in the west of Ireland and they could stop them drinking, playing cards and so on and make them better citizens and so on. So the chair was actually funded by the Earl of Roden, and he said, I think it is very unworthy of Trinity not to have a chair of Irish. The first professor of Irish, oddly enough, was from the landlord class in Connemara, and he was Thomas de Vere Cunnis from outside Clifton. And he wrote a dictionary in the 1840s to help the missionaries in the west of Ireland. Now, similarly to Eccle, things got actually worse in Connemara, very, very bad in 1880. And when conditions were as bad as anything in the Great Famine, according to the descriptions of the Quakers. And then the Quakers made a great effort to help people with assisted passages to America in 1882-83. But in the end, and they never proselytized the Quakers, but in the end the church became afraid. They were losing people, shopkeepers were losing people, and the politicians, Davitt and Parnell, didn't like the mass exodus of people. So that scheme fizzled out, but it was headed by Chook, a Quaker, and it was one, he thought it out very carefully. But in the States, they were afraid of having paupers downloaded on them or sent to them, and the assisted emigration schemes stopped after a few years. But in any case, the chair of Irish in Trinity belongs to that period.
Well, actually, one thing on the in relation to the teaching of Irish in Trinity, I mean, Trinity's origins are as much like a seminary for the Church of Ireland as much as a university. And Irish was taught under Bishop William Beadle as Protestant in the early part of the 17th century. And it's precisely for that reason, to equip newly ordained members of the Church of Ireland to go out and preach. So it might have been a chair, but it's an idea that actually goes back to the origins of the university itself.
Thank you. Not to digress into discussion of the Irish language, but relevant to what we have just been talking about now, were it not for Queen Elizabeth I, who translated, who paid to have a Bible translated into Gaeilge in order to commune with the wild savages that were outside the door of Trinity College at that stage, Irish would never have survived. Now, that's a very, very big topic, but it's ironic that we owe it to Elizabeth I that we have the language. Owen McNeill was the next person after that who really saved it. Thank you.
I wish to say, Tommy, the Irish language was an inherent part of Edward Langell's philosophy, and he had taken it from Christopher Anderson in the Scottish Highlands in the 1820s, who had said that we must bring the Bible to the people in their own languages. So he actually had the Bible translated, Edward Langell, and so on. So it was very much part of his thinking in setting up the mission in Acre.
I'm keeping an eye on the time here. And before we finish, I just wanted to ask the panel about the movie, Black 47, which is the only film ever made with a famine theme in it. So what do you think, Peter? Is it any good?
Well, it's not the only movie ever made. There was a version of Knock and a Gow,
okay,
by Charles Kickham, made back in
the silent
era. But yeah, your general point is right. I mean, I enjoyed Black 47. I suppose I shouldn't have, but I did. You know, because it's a very well made, very well told story. It's very powerfully put together. I mean, it is what it is. It's very much based on the Western. Yeah, exactly. It's that Western tradition of the revenge movie.
Film, people are looking for a documentary.
That's right. No, exactly. No, that's quite right. I know, and the atmosphere is very powerful. Use of the Irish language in that film, I think, is very well done. You know, if you don't go to that movie, as you say, for a documentary, but it works within its own.
In terms of the history in it. Some critics said it's a little bit clunky, but would you give it the...
The most interesting thing... I mean, you're always going to get the kind of stereotypical landlord, but the most interesting thing to me at all is the identification. The first victim of our revenger is the Gombeen man, which is, you know, that's a tradition that goes back to William Carleton and the Black Prophet. You know, the Gombeen man as the kind of oppressor of the poor as much as the land.
He kind of works as we start off the land grabber, then the magistrate, then the landlord.
Yeah.
Like he kind of.
Yeah.
Oh, spoiler! Sorry,
shouldn't give that away.
Patricia, what do you think?
Yeah, I liked it, and I was trying to figure out because I got very mixed reviews. So why did I like it? One of the reasons I think it tells a slant. It comes at the story sideways because it's more like a cowboy thriller type. So you're not actually doing it straight on. And the other thing is actually an emotive thing. You know, we argue about it was a genocide or we're not a genocide. But there is such a huge emotive content in it that I felt emotionally, I got carried in. Somebody is responsible for this. And you got you were following this kind of emotional thing,
yeah.
but as a revenge cowboy thing. So it dealt with some of the emotional stuff. And also I thought the Irish language bit, you get the sense of that rupture in terms of culture and language and so on. I thought maybe it tried a little bit too hard to show that it had done all this research and Superism was in and the Dublin Castle and whatever. But I liked it. I thought it worked.
It's funny that you talk about that emotional response because the character in the film who articulates that is this young English foot boy or whatever he is, assistant. Yeah. So and he's the one who just says, just feed these people. You know, he responds, you know, totally emotionally.
Yes.
And I think that was quite clever to use somebody who's not an Irish character at all.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And John, what did you make of it?
Well, I have a 3-year-old, so the last film I saw was Paddington Bear. So I haven't got around to it yet.
That's the subject of the nexus of Paddington Bear and the famine, John.
Jesus,
be our next,
count me in.
Our next topic. Anyone else in the audience with a view on it of the movie, or indeed of the exhibition that we mentioned? Just if you use the microphone, so we can hear you.
Just going to say about the Stephen Ray character.
Fascinating character.
Very interesting character.
Yeah.
He's a kind of a really weird Irish version of the Greek chorus, commenting on what's going on, and especially when he's explaining to the landlord, and by the way, they use Strokestown House as the setting for that shootout in the day. But he's trying to explain to him about what would happen to an Irish Colleen if she was given the same chances as the English woman. You know, I thought he was a very interesting character, and he played it very, very well. He upset a few people singing his song on the mule as he was going along. I know one lady who was a famous Irish soprano couldn't take it at all, but I think she was looking for the wrong film.
Right. Now, anyone else want to come in? Because I'm going to wrap up here. I think we've looked at this from all sorts of angles. Peter, can I just finish with you, though? In terms of what sort of books are we going to be expecting next down the pipeline? What are the issues? What are the hot topics in relation to the famine?
Well,
coming
I think
down the line?
Some of the really most exciting and interesting work that's appeared in recent years has been local studies, very rich local studies. You know, Patricia's book, which I'm really looking forward to reading, I have it sitting on my desk, is one of those. You know, but books like Brendan McSivna's The End of Outrage, you know, which are deep drillings down into the intimate
history of the
family. Could you give us a quick
gist of what that's about? Just
Well, I mean, this is kind of a village study. It's based on
famous French book.
That's right. You know, it's based on an episode in which there's a kind of criminal case having to do with land. You know, and how different people have kind of place their relationship with the landlord and with the family relationship in this village in County Donegal. It's a very kind of rich, thick description.
And the author is descended from some of them as well, by the way.
Yeah, and you know, Kieran O'Murkata's book, Figures in a Famine Landscape, I'd very strongly recommend as well, which is set in West Clare, which looks at key individuals in this highly contested area. And the West Clare evictions by the Vandeleurs are some of the worst, you know, in the later stages of the famine. But he's looking at the Vandeleurs, but also the local clergy, the local relief officials, Charles Kennedy, who's the poor law inspector, a key figure in opening up the scandal of what's going on down there. And, books like that. You know, I think there's a huge wealth of local stories and which can be done in quite a sophisticated way now. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm placed into comparative perspective. I think comparative history is the other area which we've seen a really lot of very interesting work done, placing the Irish famine into wider, just as we're looking down, we're also looking up and out at, Cormac O'Groda has kind of really led the field there, and kind of looking at how the Irish famine relates to famines like that in Finland in the 1860s, the Ukraine in the 1930s, you know, famines in British India, et cetera, in the late century.
Yemen, 2018.
Yeah, so this keeps us relevant. Never ends. Keeps it relevant.
John, yeah.
One thing that I'd be interested to see how this would get written on. I mean, I wrote a kind of overview history of Ireland there last year, and when I was going through the 19th century bit, the stuff that I found most fascinating and eye-opening wasn't necessarily the famine itself, but its impact in its aftermath and the profound social changes and cultural change that followed in its wake. That process of change, the mass immigration, depopulation, language shift, all these issues that have essentially kind of shaped the society that we're still living in. And I think it's no exaggeration to say that perhaps the big dividing line for me, that divides early modern Ireland and Ireland as categories is not the Act of Union or the end of the Napoleonic Wars, it's the famine. And the change that flowed from that disruptive event in the second half of the 19th century seems to be a fascinating subject, an important subject to study, and one that you'd like. I know that Brendan McSibben's book touches on it, but the three-year-old wouldn't let me read that either. But it's that kind of couple of generations that came after the famine and before the revolutionary years of the 20th century. There's something there that's really fascinating and important, and you'd like to see being explored and teased out more widely.
Okay, I'm going to wrap things up there. I just want to get back to the job in hand, which is to plug these books here. This is The Great Famine, History of Ireland, Pen and Sword Collaboration, edited by John Gibney here. And this is Patricia's The Preacher and the Prelate, about the Achill mission. As I said, the Cambridge history was too big to bring in here.
It is available as an e-book, so you can get it through libraries. I mean, it's kind of big four-volume set, yeah. Very expensive, but libraries will have it in hard copy and hopefully an e-book version as well.
If you can't afford a book, you can read the review in History Ireland. Now, just to say then, tomorrow I will be doing another session tomorrow in the RDS at 2:45, the RDS library, where I'll be having a chat with David McCullough, whose second volume of his De Valera book has just come out. And I'll also be talking to Fergus O'Farrell, who's brought out this shorter Life and Times series on Cathal Brua. So we'll be doing a two-hander interview on that. And the next History Ireland Head School will be on Tuesday, the 4th of December. And this is in collaboration with the National Photographic Archive. In fact, it will be held in the National Photographic Archive in Temple Bar to go along with their exhibition From Ballots to Bullets, Ireland 1918 to 1919. So we have Brian Hanley, Liz Gillis and Niamh Purcell. So I'd just like to finally thank our speakers here today, John Gibney, Peter Gray and Patricia Byrne. I'd like to thank you, the audience, in particular those people who made a contribution from the floor, and I hope to see you at future Hedge Schools. So thank you very much. Thanks, Patricia.